Good afternoon. I'm convening this meeting of the Joint Committee on Student Success Subcommittee on Revenue. This is February 19th. We have an informational meeting this afternoon. Mr. Alanak.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So I have in OLIS, there are two documents that we'll go through. One of them is a few slides from actually a presentation I made to the committees a couple years ago, but I pulled it out. It's relevant for the discussion this session. And then the second one is a list of bullet points of considerations when the committee is evaluating tax policy. So the first one here, the taxation of business income. These are slides that basically go through, I've lost control of the mouse. Wait, there we go.
Yeah, very rapidly.
So we have the different business entity types. We have sole proprietors, partnerships, S corporations, and C corporations, and then LLCs. As the committee is aware, LLC isn't a filing status. Most of them file as partnerships. However, they can file as any one of the other entities. And LLCs that file as a sole proprietor are called single member LLCs, sometimes disregarded entities. But when we look at the tax data, they show up mostly within partnerships, but across any of the categories. So the information here is based on tax year 2014. We are updating this to more recent information, 2016. That's not quite ready yet, but this is what I had available, and it conveys the magnitude of the information at hand. So within 2014, there were most of the businesses were sole proprietors. About 65% of the businesses were sole proprietors, and that's just under 280,000. And C corporations, just under 30,000, about 7%. And then pass-through entities make up about 28%. It's about 120,000 businesses. And of those pass-through entities, it's split about 50-50 between partnerships and S-corps, so that as a total share, each of those entities represents about 14% of businesses, and they come in at right around 60,000 entities. Historically, this information I can only find at the federal level. It's a share of business receipts for the different types. And so if we go back to 1980, about 80 to 85% of the business receipts were received by C corporations, with just smaller shares for the S corporations, partnerships, and non-farm sole proprietors. But you can see over time, as we moved up to 2012, the larger share that the pass-through entities have taken. So we've had that structural shift over the past 30 or 40 years.
If I may, thank you, Madam Chair.
Do we either know or at least believe that this trend has continued? I mean, I get that we only have it till 2012, but there hasn't like been a big jump back up in C corps that we're aware of.
No, it's generally holding. For C corporations at the state level, we're right around 30,000 every year. We're dipping down to, we have about a percentage point lost every year. And that can be from corporations merging, and can also be the occasional switch from a C corporation to an S corporation. But most of that, I think, is the growth of new businesses. They just, it's so easy to start off as an LLC and then switch to a partnership or an S corporation.
But harder to switch to a C corp.
Well, there isn't much, it depends on the need for the business if they need to go to a C corporation.
Okay.
Generally, that will happen if a company has an IPO, initial public offering, or if they want broader access to capital.
Okay.
And there can be a lot of reasons for it, but in terms of starting businesses, so I think a lot of the growth is coming from these pass-through entities.
Okay. And then final, just quick note on this. With the tax reform bill that was passed at the end of 2017, that significant drop in the corporate tax rate, is that either, does anyone theorize that that might move the needle back towards C corps?
That's a topic of constant discussion. With the lowering of the C corp rates, would businesses move back to C corporations, or would they, at least on paper, construct additional corporations? And the CPAs that I've talked to have said that they're definitely looking at it. I'm not sure, I don't get the sense that there's going to be a rush to do that, so it might be a gradual tempering of the trend that we've seen.
Right. Thank you. And I just, and I know that Senator Bentz, in past conversations when we were both on the House Revenue Committee, I know you are knowledgeable about all of the things that it takes to become a C Corp and that it is a, and so that's what I always think of, your words about how challenging it can be and how, as it's declined. So I just, I am curious though about whether that will, just going forward, whether we will see that.
You mean more C Corps or continued decline? I'm sorry, Mr.
Yeah.
I think in the last 10 years in our law firm, we formed one C Corp. We formed hundreds of LLCs, 10 sub S's, okay. 3 partnerships.
And a partridge in a pear tree?
Yeah.
Okay. Just checking. Thank you.
The reason, Madam Chair,
yes.
The reason that purple isn't declining is until recently it was so hard to get out of a C Corp, you were locked in.
That's the new federal law
may change that. So it's going to be really interesting to see, now that that tax rate's been reduced so dramatically, whether people are going to use that as an opportunity to escape that format.
Thank you.
So the next 3 slides are Oregon data for 2014. A lot of this, there are estimates. It's a combination of Department of Revenue data and some Internal Revenue Service data that I use to come up with these estimates. We have business income, our tax returns here, and then the other 2 slides are sales and income. So for 2014, 427,000 businesses in total. And it's just a stacked bar chart of the prior pie chart. Then the next couple of slides are along these lines in terms of presenting the information. So here you can see that the pass-throughs are split out between, I tried to split out some of the LLCs to show that, for example, the pass-throughs, about 41,000 appear to be LLCs. 17,000 are straight up partnerships, and then 61,000 are S corporations. And then the sole proprietors divided there, trying to, again, identify the LLCs. The main goal here was to dive into the data a little bit to see if we can pull out the LLCs. And there's some information reported at the federal level that provides that, and I took those shares and applied that to Oregon data. So now if we look at the estimate of Oregon sales in 2014, it's just under $318 billion. And this kind of ties to prior discussions where when we've talked about a tax base of the gross receipts being around $300 billion. This is part of where that information comes from. And you can see that about 2/3 of that is from C corporations. So $192 billion Oregon sales are from C corporations. And then pass-throughs account for about $110 billion. And then sole proprietors account for about $16. And so the idea here is small number of taxpayers account for a large share of the sales. And then if we bounce to estimated business income, it shifts a little bit here, but we've gone from $317 billion in Oregon sales to just under $18 billion in estimated business income. And this is the income that gets reported by the C corporations on those tax forms, as well as the amount from the pass-through entities that show up on the personal income tax returns. So for 2014, just under $8 billion in business income for C corporations, and just under $6.3 billion for pass-throughs.
Yes.
Are you using business income synonymously with profits?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. It's that bottom line number that's showing up on the tax return to be taxed. And then just taking these key metrics and putting them side by side, the bar chart on the left shows the number of returns. So sole proprietors are 65% of the returns, but then their share of sales is about 5%, and the income and tax for them is just under 20%. And at the other end of the spectrum, so to speak, we have C corporations comprising 5 to 10% of businesses, but 60% of sales and 45% or so of income, and then the tax. So as we're talking about any sort of new tax, gross receipts tax, VAT, these are this is kind of the core information that we'll use to base estimates on. And that was the last part of that slide. So I can, if there are any questions, I can move on to the next, the bullet points.
I have a question. I'm trying to grok the meaning of some of this. And when I look at this slide, at first I was comparing, going back and forth, comparing the colors of the bar chart on business income to Oregon sales. Oregon sales, and then the next chart after that was business income. So there's a very noticeable shift in proportion for the green section, C Corps, and non-farm sole, the orange. Those are the two that look to me to have significant proportional shifts. Then when I look at the last one, the share of key metrics, the story that I see there on sole proprietors, wasn't quite matching up with what I thought I understood from the two previous bar charts.
I think that's an optical situation. This bar chart, the key metrics, it's a share. It's everything's normalized to 100%. And the prior ones are dollar amounts. So I think that, because it's not a percentage, I think that can shift. If you're going back and forth there, that.
Okay. I think I get it.
I could normalize that, I think. I think that's the key difference between the two.
All right, thank you. Any other questions on this part of the information? Yes, Senator Betts.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Chris, I'm looking at your 2014 estimated Oregon sales. Do you have, first question is, do we know what that is today? Any wild guess?
The early estimates we have for 2016 are at about $335 billion. There's always a time lag, but we're using tax return data, so there's a couple year time lag.
And for purposes of discussing a receipts tax, sales are receipts?
Correct.
And Madam Chair, if I follow up with this, Chris, again, looking at that slide, the huge share of any gross receipts tax would thus be paid by corporations, be they C or S?
That would likely be the case. That's part of this information, is to show where that tax burden would land. It would be affected by any sort of threshold or any kinds of exemptions. This is just everything on the table. All the amounts. So, for example, there's often talk of a $1 million threshold, or even $150,000 or $500,000 threshold, and that's where a lot of the sole proprietors get excluded, because a lot of the sole proprietors have gross receipts of less than $100,000, for example. So you shrink the number of businesses affected, but it doesn't have a commensurate impact on the sales, since they represent such a smaller share of the sales.
Yes.
So the key question, at least at this point, is when you look at the income, which is in the next slide, and one is trying to figure out how that GST would affect income. Because it doesn't matter about income, right? It's merely a matter of how many dollars are flowing through the door. That's how you pay the gross receipts tax.
Right, yeah.
So the issue then is, as you look at that estimated business income, is there any correlation between gross receipts on the one hand and income on the other? And I'm not sure I'm seeing it. Maybe there is. that grocery receipt, the question is, the ability to pay that tax isn't dependent upon how much you made, it just becomes another expense.
Correct, that's the nature of the tax.
That's the nature of the tax.
Come in, and that's one of the arguments about it, is the profit or loss of a given business in a given year. And these are net numbers, so everything's thrown in the pot. It's kind of the bottom line macro perspective.
Yes, representatives.
Thank you, Madam Coach. Can we go one slide back? When we look at the estimated Oregon sales, I understand what you're saying with the C corporations and the sub S's. Has there been any analysis to determine what we might project in terms of change in sub S membership? Because quite often the reason folks form a sub S is for tax liability purposes. And usually it might be a husband and a wife or one or two partners, and they form that sub S. Usually the shareholders are very limited just by the nature of what a sub S is. And I'm wondering if as we're having this consideration, how many would abandon being a sub S and reform under an LLC or an LLP to avoid that conversation, to avoid the tax consideration.
Well, I think if shifting from one form to another under, are you talking about under a new kind of value added or?
Sure. So, I'm thinking if I'm a light manufacturer in Heppner, husband and wife, and I'm a sub S corporation, I'm going to dissolve that sub S and immediately move to an LLC or an LLP for a new form of tax protection and avoid being part of this conversation. Is it?
Well, I don't think that would matter under a business receipts tax. I mean, part of the, there are a lot of plans that are being talked about, so it's devoid of pinning it to a specific plan. If the tax would apply to all businesses, part of the idea there is to avoid, to not create an incentive to do that.
Got it. Yeah, as soon as you brought in the definition, all businesses, right?
Right.
Okay, I understand that now. Okay.
Yes.
Chris, do you remember offhand how much, if the threshold is $1 million, how many businesses that excludes and how many are left at that point?
Yes, and I actually was trying to work on getting that into a slide. I just ran out of time. But I will get more definitive information. But when you move in from the 400,000 or so businesses, and if you create a $1 million threshold, I believe that falls to maybe 50,000-ish. Mm-hmm. And I can get you better numbers on that. I just ran out of time to include them here.
At a million.
Yes, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chris, if you just pretend for a minute there was a GST of $2 billion, how does that affect net income? The answer in two ways. Does it drive it down by just $2 billion, or am I missing something there? It wouldn't matter. Before I start about it, what happens?
I think it depends on the responses. So there's a new tax, and then how would the businesses respond in terms of passing on that tax in terms of increased prices or cutting costs elsewhere? It's all in the response there to those initial taxes. We have that initial tax, and you have that legal incidence, but how that plays out in the economy can change over time as businesses respond to the best they can to this new tax.
Well, for a moment, assume nobody passes it on. What then? The income really is, if you didn't have any income, you still got to pay the tax. It wouldn't have any. For those in that boat, there would be no decline in net income on this chart.
Right, and the negatives are subsumed in this chart because these are net numbers.
Section.
Okay. So the next list here is, again, spending time thinking about how to evaluate attacks and how businesses may respond and the response to those. This is a list of what I've called policy considerations. There are four things that economists in public finance often look at, and they're the first four: equity, efficiency, stability, and then administration. And so that was my starting point. A lot of these bullet points can fit in one or another category, and some of them are similar to topics that the committee has discussed in the past. But this was just me taking some notes down about how to think about this. And the first one here is equity, and that's the closest economists will get to the notion of fairness, because fairness is a subjective term, but this is how economists try to escape that particular question with equity. And some of the considerations there, treatment across business types, we just touched on that a minute ago about treating all businesses the same and not adding to any incentive to change a structure. There is the destination-based notion of having the tax applied to sales in Oregon as opposed to an origin-based tax. And that's simply where, for example, the Ohio model focuses. And then equity also, I imagine this will come up, is sectoral differences. For given sectors, whether you're talking about a law firm, a doctor's office, a manufacturing company, on how a given tax, whatever tax that may be, and how that it affects the sectors differently. And often within the notion of equity,
I was wondering, since we're looking largely at a couple choices here, as you go through these, give us the pros and cons of a receipts tax versus a VAT tax on these categories.
So now a VAT tax, so the receipts tax is the broad base and just dollars in the door. And a VAT can take on different flavors. It's when you start reducing stuff from the business. So some of the things that come to mind are even the sectoral differences. We've seen from some other charts that when you step away from gross, from one perspective, gross receipts can be argued to be equitable because it's just the dollar in the door gets taxed. An argument for a VAT side gets at the tax being based on the value added. The value added for a firm can vary across the sectors. If a company has a lot of expensive inputs and then the value added, it's you're starting to get to that notion to small margin businesses. But if the perspective is the value added, then that would argue for one of those taxes and the differences in the percentage of value added across sectors that come to mind. Some of the other, the usual language economists use here are benefits received and ability to pay. And so those come into mind where receipts tax or a value-added tax, if that's still owed, if a company is in a negative position for the year, and that now you're getting into the argument for an income tax. But then you have the benefits received principle. So even if a company has a loss for a given year, they're still benefiting, arguably, from public services. So as the committee has discussed before, a lot of these considerations, as I've called here, can conflict with one another. And it's often a balance in crafting public policy. It's a balancing approach for those kinds of things. The second bullet point, efficiency, and this is all about trying to minimize economic distortions and responses to attacks. And so some of the things that come into play here are accountability for the tax, so that the taxpayers know where the money is coming from and how it's being used. That helps to, if there's more understanding around that, there can be less of a negative response to the tax, and similar to transparency, and then really getting at the ability to avoid and evade. I don't know if there's any mantra for economists, but, and this is kind of leading into the next one, is a broad-based low rate. Because any tax, the higher a rate goes, the more incentive there is for taxpayers to try and take actions to avoid the tax. Any tax adds takes markets out of equilibrium a little bit, and then taxpayers will respond. And those are arguably economic distortions that the smallest amount of tax leading to the largest amount of revenue for a desired function is what is preferable, minimizing those secondary actions that cause stakeholders to move away from their activities where there are no such tax. And that kind of gets at the ability to avoid and evade. And if a tax is structured so that it's easily avoided, then people find that, then it gets back to the first point where it's perhaps not fair, the perception of it's fair, or if it's easy to avoid or evade. And the less that there is ability to do that, then the more efficient the tax can be considered. And so here, thinking of a receipts tax to a value added, there can be arguments that the receipts tax is very transparent, but you also have situations where you get into a pyramiding where it's not necessarily obvious as a tax goes through from one business to the next. The value added can be transparent, especially if it's tied to federal definitions. And so when taxpayers pay their tax, they can just go to the federal form and there can be clarity around how that tax is calculated. The third bullet point, stability.
Before we get to that one, while we're, we've passed equity and efficiency, but how would you rate Washington's B&O tax on those first two categories?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind with the Washington B&O tax are all of the exceptions to the tax. And once you build in all of those exceptions, you start to get away from a tax that is simple and clear and arguably starts to deviate from a lot of those things. Having said that, I would imagine that as those provisions got put into place, they were often argued for on grounds of being fair or adding or creating a level playing field or something to that effect. Mm-hmm. But that's the first thing that comes to mind is all of the exceptions to the tax.
And if you have explained this already, I apologize for not remembering. In the Washington B&O tax, since there's a different tax rate for different kinds of activity, if a company is involved in more than one activity, are they taxed at the rate of the predominant activity? It, you know, this is more than 51% of what you do, or do they have to figure out, well, 37% of our business is in this category, so it's taxed at that rate, and 10% is in this category, and so it's taxed at that rate, and so on.
I believe the B&O is taxed at the activity level. And I can confirm that. But I believe if a business is operating in three different activities, then they potentially pay three different rates. Mm-hmm. It depends on the activity. It's not that the company is put into one bin. Mm-hmm. But I can confirm that.
Thank you. Senator Hass.
Thank you. on the category ability to avoid, evade, we read over the weekend that Amazon did not pay any federal. Maybe there's valid reasons for that. I don't know why that happened. Stands to reason, though, that if they didn't pay federal corporate income tax, there's a chance they didn't pay Oregon corporate income tax. So I guess I'm commentating on a question here. It's our current system is problematic on this issue of ability to avoid, evade, too. Not that there's anything illegal or wrong, but it's a problem.
And it kind of gets at, when I was mentioning economic distortions, if a tax is imposed with the higher the rate, the more incentive there is for a taxpayer to take actions, not necessarily illegal, to minimize their tax. It's tax planning.
Right.
And that happens on the income tax and with the federal level and the state level. Now, maybe with the federal corporate tax rate falling to 20%, that ostensibly reduces some of that impact, or the incentive, if you will. But that's an example of stakeholder or taxpayer response to taxes.
Yes, Senator Bass.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So how big was Washington State's tax? How, what percentage was it?
Their rate?
Yes, the rate, sorry.
I believe the base B&O rate is 0.484%, and services are 1.5%. They have four core rates. I think the most of them pay the 0.484, and then services pay 1.5, and then they have about maybe 25 or 30 other sectors that have different rates. And some of them might, I think there might have been a hazardous waste one that was like 3.3%. I'm off the top of my head, but something like that.
And a follow-up, Madam Chair. So the in the previous slide, I was going to ask if there was a way of, do we have a slide that shows how different businesses can pass on or cannot pass on the tax? Was that some of what went into Washington's development of those exceptions?
I believe I don't have a slide for there, but that really gets at the response for businesses. And if they can pass on the tax, they will, whether it's to other businesses or to consumers, or on either side, the supply side or the distribution side. Or the different rates used by B&O, my understanding is that was based on estimates of pyramiding within the state. So that, for example, the service sector, which has the higher rate, there's less pyramiding. And so they have the higher rate. But the sectors where they think there might be lower rates are more pyramiding. They have lower rates. And so the part of the impetus behind the different rate structures was the issue of pyramiding.
Okay. If the question is, this is a consumption tax, or kind of, if you can pass it on to those who are consuming. To the extent that you're a price taker, you're not going to be able to do that. Correct. So that's why I'm asking for that chart that shows us how many folks in our state are price takers, let's say, and don't have that opportunity to pass it on. They're just stuck. It's a familiar conversation because we had it two nights ago in the carbon meeting last week, where people in the farming business were coming in saying, well, we're not going to be able to pass this on because we don't have that chance. So in this conversation, the question is, do we have a chart that shows us how many people are in that space?
I don't readily have a chart, but I can spend some time thinking about that. One of the responses to that is tied in with the destination-based. So exporters wouldn't be paying. So to the extent a business exports, any new tax that we've been talking about wouldn't be applied to exports. And so that's one of the responses we have to that.
Follow-up, Manager. I think in that case, it was a woman who farmed here near town and had 12 different products. And I think many of them were not being sold out of state. They're being sold into food processing. So that wouldn't be out of state, would it?
No, if they were sold in Oregon, those would count as Oregon sales. And part of the destination-based is even companies outside of Oregon, as they sell into state, would be picked up. And to, again, getting back at the broad base across all business types, so anybody selling into the state, the tax would apply to them as well, which it doesn't fully exist with the income tax in the way that's been structured.
Follow-up, Madam Chair. So when I bought some books the other day from Amazon online, what happens?
Under one of the taxes that we're discussing?
Yes, because they sell into state, but would this tax pick that sale up?
Yes. We should pick that up. Anything sold into the state. We haven't quite gotten into all of the intricacies of the administration side and exactly how that would work, but that would be the intent of the tax.
You bought physical books printed on paper?
Yes, I know it's odd.
I'm with you.
I needed something to set my lamp on.
I've got my TV on the Steve Jobs book.
I'm not going to tell you what they were.
Well, I usually go to my public library and borrow books, but perhaps they don't have the type of books that you needed.
Madam Chair, when I used to have time before they had these night committees, I did the same thing.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To follow up on that, so those books that Senator Bentz bought on Amazon, how would they pay tax on those now, in the system we have now?
It depends on the business, but the business, they have income from those sales, and so the net income from that business, if they have nexus in Oregon, if they're a C corporation and they have nexus in Oregon, then they would pay according to their single sales factor. But with the income tax and public law 86272, there's some corporations who can sell into the state, and they don't really have nexus. All they're doing is selling into the state. It's a minimal connection, and so they wouldn't be paying.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
And is that, from an economist's standpoint, the policy reason for arguing for a gross receipts tax, because it casts the wide net and it's a broader base?
Yeah, that's getting at some of the key pieces there are broad base and stability and the consumption side, and all of those aspects of the tax. And it's, yeah.
Because you're capturing businesses who previously had no nexus, didn't pay any tax, they've just sold their stuff here, but now they would be paying a fraction on the sale of their stuff.
The sale into the destination-based structure of the tax would require that.
Yes, Senator.
And that's really a good point. Do we have a chart or anything on how many of those corporations there are that don't have nexus that do sell in? How big a population that is?
That's an interesting question. There are a couple of bills that try to get at that, and because they're not filing, I don't have a good answer to that question yet. Because if they're just selling into the state and they're not required to file an income tax return, they're not on our radar screen, so to speak. Mm. So it's on the to-do list of to try and back into an estimate some way. It's for any of the estimates that we include on sales and consumption, it's embedded in there, but how to pull that out is a little bit different.
But they are competing with Oregon businesses. To the extent that they're selling something that is also available through an Oregon business.
Right.
Just for curiosity, does Amazon have nexus in Oregon?
I'm reluctant to talk about any particular company. Sorry.
They have fulfillment centers here, though, don't they? Wouldn't that create nexus? They're fulfillment centers.
Thank you. I think there was testimony today in one of my other committees about Amazon's new site in Troutdale. I don't know if that's nexus or not, but they have 1,700 employees or something like that. But that's not my question. So if this tax had been in place and when I received my books, would it have been called out then on the receipt that I had just paid that tax? What do you anticipate will happen if there is that tax? I mean, will it be a stealth tax hidden? No one ever knows, I just paid more for my books, or will it be called out?
That's one of the differences between receipts tax and a retail sales tax. So a retail sales tax is a transactional tax. So if you go into a state that has the sales, so if you were in Washington, went up to Washington and bought those books, you'd get a receipt, you have the price of the books, and then the 6 or 7% tax rate, and you'd see it on the receipt. A gross receipts type of tax, is it a transactional tax? So I actually don't know if they would report anything on that receipt if you'd see that, or if it would just be at their annual filing or quarterly filing when they report to a Department of Revenue what their gross receipts were and then a tax payment along with that. Especially if you're talking about threshold, so if there's $1 million in threshold, so if it were a small store, they may not be on the radar screen in terms of having Oregon sales of, say, $1 million. So there'd be no reason to collect that tax until you get to sales above $1 million.
I took us off track when you were starting to do number three.
Stability really gets at that broad-based low rate, and even the consumption side, consumption tends to be a little more stable than income. And I included rate structure in here. Many of these I kind of bounced around which category they would fit in, but the rate structure, if you have one rate, then there isn't any need to try and change a sector. One of the things that we heard in prior sessions was when the discussion turned to different rates for different sectors, if there was any ability for a company to switch from one sector to the next. I'm not sure that's entirely possible, but that was one of the points that was raised a couple of years ago. So the fourth point is administration. And so the way I view this is on both sides of the equation, the ease of filing for the taxpayer and any sort of administrative costs for the taxpayer as well as the state. So costs to the state's Department of Revenue to administer the tax. You would presumably want administrative costs as low as possible, and that would presumably coincide with ease of filing so that when a taxpayer has to file the tax return, it's as inexpensive as possible for them. One of the ways that can happen is tying to certain definitions in federal law. As we're talking about different forms of a VAT, and we've looked at some different states, they may or may not have been pure with a VAT concept, but they would apply, or they would tie to certain provisions in federal law, so they could just take those calculations made at the federal level and apply it to the state calculation. So that's a kind of consideration. And that's what I meant by D there, connection with the federal system. And, you know, in creating a new tax, are we defining new concepts? That can be challenging for taxpayers. Not that accountants and so forth can't figure it out, but if you're coming up with new concepts, that can create confusion. And as long as we're sticking with known concepts, that eases the filing and reduces the administrative costs. And then the fifth point I've just labeled system context, and that's where taking a step back and looking at the entire tax system within the state. So if we're talking about a new tax, how does that fit in with the existing taxes that we have? And we get into a progressive rate structure. A progressive tax structure is something that the committee has talked about, so I put that bullet point there. And then the last two, policy adjustments and competitiveness, is something as we've looked at information. So starting with policy adjustments, that gets a notion of flexibility for the policymakers to make adjustments as needed as a new tax is implemented and how are taxpayers responding. Is it our collections what we thought they would be? What is the response from the private sector in terms of responding to those, and the ability for the legislature to modify the tax policy? I'll just leave it there. And then competitiveness, we've had, that one comes to mind. We've had some 50 state comparisons of business tax burden divided by gross state product, for example, and how does that fit? And what does this do to the tax burden or the tax competitiveness for businesses in the overall picture? And so those, I guess, musings on a tax.
Senator Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you go back up to that ability to avoid and evade, do you have a list of ways that people can avoid this tax?
I don't, but markets can be pretty efficient and they can find them. On the different taxes, this is avoid, evade, wasn't necessarily thinking legal or illegal, but to the extent that they can, anything that is taxed, then if there's a way to minimize it, it all gets back to tax planning. And so if you have a receipts tax, if you sell into the state, you have the tax. You can't, the only way to avoid that is to not sell into the state. Now, if you move away from that and start taxing a slightly different base, whether it's some form of a value-added tax, and if there are some things that aren't taxed, then taxpayer behavior can shift to the extent possible away from that which is taxed to that which is not taxed. taxed. And that really depends on the specifics of a tax policy.
Yes.
If we had this kind of tax, would it be deductible from state, from federal taxes?
I would expect so. I don't see why it wouldn't.
So basically, the effective rate would be lower.
Yeah, and you have the ability to basically export or shift some of that tax to the federal level. Now, and that's something I'll keep in mind as we get into any sort of details of the tax to see if that isn't the case.
Okay.
Well, when we look at a gross receipts tax that has exemptions for certain industries, is that, are we moving towards a VAT tax? I mean, is that, are we almost at a VAT tax?
You kind of, if you can think back to some of the graphs, you start to move in that direction. It depends on what you're subtracting from the gross receipts, from a receipts base. So you can exempt certain sectors or items, and that isn't necessarily a VAT. A VAT is within a business, the input. And so we've looked at states that subtracted cost of goods sold or business inputs or subtracted labor costs. And as you start moving down that path, it starts to look a little more like a VAT tax. It depends on how far down that path you go.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That makes me think, so on a VAT, in a VAT structure, could you make the argument that if labor costs were what you subtracted, that that would be an incentive for more hiring for businesses in your state? Or am I, is that an overly simplified way to think about it?
There's a lot that goes into for a business hiring labor. And if that's part of the tax base, it could be argued that that's an incentive or disincentive. Whether you're taxing it or not taxing it. To the extent that actually has an impact on the demand for labor or the supply of labor is a slightly different question. Because at the end of the day, the tax is, as I think was mentioned earlier, is a cost to the business. And to the extent if they need to, they can pass on those costs to either forward to the people or businesses they sell to, or backwards to their suppliers if they can. And that'll depend on the individual markets and the individual circumstances of the businesses at hand.
Okay. And follow up.
Yes.
Thank you. And just a little bit related to that, another thing I had been thinking about, which is we talk a lot about, you know, what about taxes getting passed on to consumers. And ultimately, you could make that argument about any kind of tax. Correct? I mean, because one of the things you work into the cost of doing business is, how much am I going to have to pay? How much am I going to have to pay for my taxes? How much am I going to have to pay labor? How much am I going to pay for my materials? And it's part of your overall pricing structure in theory, right? Regardless
Yes.
of what kind of tax system it is, you could make the argument that any tax structure could be built into your costing model, and therefore you could argue it's being passed on to consumers.
At the end of the day, economists view taxes as being paid by one of three groups, either consumers, labor through lower wages than they would have been otherwise, or the owners of capital. So you have those households, the members of those households, wherever they land on that. So because taxes are a cost in doing business, then they get passed on to one of those three groups. That's kind of what we refer to as the final incidence. And that can take on a lot of different forms. And it's not always easy to tell exactly how that happens when we're looking from third-party data, if you will, or at arm's length, rather. Is it can show up as an increase in the cost of services and goods to the consumer. It can show up as an impact on labor by wages not growing as fast as they would have absent the tax, or even showing up on the owners of capital where the return to capital is less than it would otherwise without the tax.
Okay.
It's with the tax and without the tax. So You have the returns to those three, you have an average wage level, you have a return to capital, and then the cost of goods and services with the taxes that we have. And if all of the taxes were immediately removed somehow, what would change? Who, where would all of that benefit go to? Would it go to the owners of capital, or labor, or the consumers?
And if I may, and in the most respectful way, that sounds a lot more like an intellectual exercise than perhaps that you can't really do that in real life significantly.
Right, you can't, and it's a point of much debate in the literature about who bears those costs.
Right, okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much for preparing this outline of considerations. It's very helpful, and I appreciated being able to hear from the economist's point of view what those considerations are, and then being able to have some of our initial discussions on, well, what does that mean if it were a VAT or a gross receipts, or how does that play out in these various areas to consider. Is there any other discussion for tonight? That's the end of our material.
Mm-hmm.
Our meeting is adjourned.